This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Manning Marable says that as far as he can tell, people are more conscious of race in the United States than in any other part of the world. Marable is an African-American intellectual who knows that racism is very real, yet he thinks our obsession with racial politics and racial identity is too divisive. Marable directs the Institute for Research in African-American Studies at Columbia University. In his new collection of essays, Beyond Black and White, he writes about race and politics and how African-American leadership has changed since the Civil Rights Movement. Marable says he reassessed a lot of his ideas about race while he was writing this book.
Race creates a kind of parallel universe where black and white Americans live in the same political and geographical space, but perceive reality in fundamentally different ways. Race codes our language, our imagination, even our dreams. And yet, even though race seems fixed and permanent, it really is not. The dynamic of race is structured into policies and practices of inequality, where African Americans work harder and receive less, where they go to the bank and statistically, blacks with the same credit profile of white Americans are toned down for loans at twice the rate of whites, where African Americans have inferior health care or poor schools for their children. We code these inequalities as racial, but beneath race lies the powerful dynamic of social class. And what we have to do is go beyond the discourse of black and white to recognize that it is true. We have a real burden of racial inequality in this country. But what drives that burden is the social inequality of class, which exists for millions of Americans who are not black.
You say we need a new politics that takes into account America's new multiculturalism, that takes into account class as well as race. What kind of politics are you talking about?
I call it the politics of democratic transformation. The civil rights movement was informed by a strategy of integration, that is, black people being interspersed within the existing structure or arrangements of power in American society. That moved us beyond Jim Crow, but it really didn't address the question, the material questions of democracy. You have a right to vote, but do you have a human right to a job? We had the right for freedom of expression, but how do we address the serious problems of health care and educational inequality and social inequality that exist in the black community? Integration doesn't do it. Similarly, racial separatism or black nationalism doesn't do it. It's an intellectual and political dead end. Part of what has to be done is a national conversation about race and racism, deconstructing notions of race, and for white Americans more than anything else to understand that the vast majority of whites lose from racism. They do not benefit from it.
What were your impressions of the Million Man March?
Well, I think that the civil rights movement in 1963 held a march on Washington that challenged the conscience of this country to dismantle racial segregation. It had a very coherent policy agenda, the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and a jobs bill. It was led by Dr. Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph. The march, the Million Man March, in 1995 differs in a fundamental way from the 63 March. First, the 63 March had a policy agenda. This march did not. Its focus was on atonement, that black men should confess their own contradictions, their shortcomings within the black community. They should seek atonement from God and themselves. They should be responsible for their own self-uplift. The agenda of the Million Man March said very little, if anything, on public policy issues. At a time when you have the contract with America, you have conservative Republican control of the Congress, for a black organization or black motion to go to Washington, D.C. and say little, if anything, about conservative public policy, I feel is unpardonable. But I understand the positive elements of that march, why it was that so many young African-American men felt a cathartic sense of joy, of coming together, of making a commitment to each other to address the community's problems.
Excuse me, it wasn't just young men who felt the importance of that coming together. It was men who were older, too.
Well, that's true. The message paralleled the Promise Keepers, a fairly conservative, male-only movement. And the whole idea that the black community can be empowered through intervention by men without looking at the serious problems and the contradictions confronting African-American women pushes us down a road of sexism that really will not liberate anyone.
Are you so surprised at how popular Farrakhan has become?
No, I'm not surprised at all. I've known Farrakhan for about 20 years. Lewis has the ability to put his finger on the genuine, the very deeply felt the grievances and the anger that exists in our central cities, especially within the hip-hop generation, African-Americans in their 20s and 30s, and African-American unemployed and poor people. He recognizes the social holocaust that exists in our central cities.
Do you think that Farrakhan's increasing visibility and political clout is going to do good or do harm or some of both?
Well, clearly, a politics that is grounded in patriarchy and misogyny, a politics that is based on anti-Semitism, a politics of homophobia, a politics of division that pits one group against another, is not only not democratic, it's not a strategic vision that can liberate even the people for whom it supposedly speaks. The great strength of the black freedom struggle has been our democratic vision as we have struggled against segregation, against slavery over five generations ago. We have articulated a democratic vision of what this society could become. And in doing so, we have spoken to people beyond black and white. We've spoken to Hispanics and American Indians. We've spoken to people throughout the globe. That when you saw the democratic upsurgence in Eastern Europe at the end of the 1980s, it was no accident that the people of Czechoslovakia sang, "We shall overcome." That's the democratic and the egalitarian tradition of our people. We need to return to that language.
Where are you looking for new leadership?
The leadership is going to emerge and is emerging from community-based organizations that have not been defined by traditional civil rights values or perspectives. I'll give you an example. I live in Harlem, and over the last several years, there was a mobilization in West Harlem against a sewage treatment facility that's off on the Hudson, about 140th Street. A number of people began to be galvanized around issues of environmental racism. You had poor blacks and Latinos, Dominicans, beginning to coalesce with affluent upper-class whites who live in Morningside Heights around Columbia University. You usually think of environmental issues as people who live in the Northwest who are concerned about saving the spotted owl. But environmental racism, pollution, all of these kinds of concerns are real inner city issues. Issues like lead poisoning in the paint in the South Bronx have now galvanized black and Latino low-income people. So it's around issues of daily life, of education, of health care, the environment, reproductive rights, women's rights, education, that you can bring together a multi-class coalition of poor and working-class people and middle-income people. Not around issues of race, not around issues of difference in that sense, but around day-to-day issues that affect people's daily needs.
My guest is Manning Marable. His new collection of essays is called Beyond Black and White. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Manning Marable. His new book is called Beyond Black and White. Now, you founded and now direct the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. What are some of the controversies on your campus and in your department about multiculturalism or Afrocentrism?
Our institute is not a department. It's a research center, and we publish a journal, Race and Reason. We also hold annual conferences on academic issues and public policy issues affecting the black community. And we also direct the undergraduate major at Columbia University in African American Studies. our campus is like all the other campuses throughout the country. There is a real sense of racial polarization and also a sense of alienation between black students and white students around a whole host of issues. White higher education was never designed to speak to black realities or Hispanic realities. And it's only been over the last generation that a multicultural program has begun to be put in place in the core of our curricula.
Now, let's get specific for a second. What's an example of an African-American reality that you have felt either as a student in your earlier years or as a professor more recently that wasn't addressed by the curriculum?
Literally everything wasn't addressed. You have the great, as we call them today, the great white males whose names are carved above our libraries, whose texts are mandatory reading in the general education courses. That African American studies as an intellectual discipline did not exist at white campuses until 30 years ago. And all that is the black intellectual tradition, the scholarship and research in the social sciences and humanities of black scholars. It's our experiment in multiracial democracy in the context of education is still fresh and new. And the best approach to multiculturalism is not to insist on diversity as divisive, but as diversity as complementary. That is, we all learn something. We all learn more about ourselves when we learn about best when we learn about others. That there is a real value for African American students learning Shakespeare, but there's a profound value of white students reading Toni Morrison and James Baldwin.
You write about Afrocentrism in your new book, and there's parts of it that you not only relate to, but you think are very very helpful, very positive, but other parts of Afrocentrism that you find very disturbing intellectually and culturally. Let's get to the positive parts first.
Well, I think that even though I want to answer this question, the way to really approach this is to think about what Afrocentrism is within the context of the broader term multiculturalism. There are basically four key ideas to competing interpretations of what multiculturalism is. Afrocentrism is one, and that's basically a race reductionist view of the world or a racial essentialist view of the world that says there's black and there's white, and these are conflicting intellectual traditions. There's Eurocentrism, and in defense of that, against that, we posit Afrocentrism, values drawn solely from the tradition and the terrain, the cultural ideologies of black people. There are a lot of positives in that, that reinforce a sense of black humanity, that put us in touch with the heritage and the rituals and customs of African people throughout the diaspora. But the weakness of that is that it tends conceptually to categorize people in racial, hermetically sealed units, and that race, while it explains many things in this country, does not explain everything. There's a multiculturalism that I call corporate multiculturalism, which the large corporations put forward. And it basically says, celebrate everybody, criticize no one. And they use images of blacks and Latinos and others to market products. There's a liberal multiculturalism that dominates most academic universities. And that talks about the contributions of various people to a new discourse which transcends issues of difference. And it's rosy and it's romantic, but it really doesn't talk about issues of power. And then there's a radical multiculturalism. That's where I'm at.
What's that?
I believe that multiculturalism is a bridge through which we can engage in a constructive dialogue about difference, but we should not turn difference into a fetish, that there are fundamental commonalities that bring people together that transcend race, gender, and color.
Tell me more about how you're building this African-American studies program in line with your concept of radical multiculturalism.
You make a commitment to the best scholarship, regardless of its color, gender, or race. But that scholarship must speak to real issues and concerns within the African-American community. So in April of this year, we held a conference on the crisis of black youth, where we brought together scholars, researchers, Jeff Canada from the Children's Defense Fund, and community-based leaders and young people from Harlem and throughout black New York to talk and to discuss real issues and problems and to suggest solutions to problems within the black community for African-American young people. There has to be a link between theoretical work, scholarship, and social problems, what we call academic excellence and social responsibility.
You said that whites have to understand that the vast majority of whites lose out from racism.
Absolutely.
How?
In the last 25 years, we have seen the greatest polarization of wealth and income in the United States in our history. In 1995, the top 1% of all American households had a greater net wealth than the bottom 95% of all U.S. households. So in this era of economic polarization, you've seen white working class families and middle class families experiencing a decline in real incomes over the last 20 years. Now, how do you explain people working harder and harder and receiving less and less? So the answers of the conservatives all focus around race. And take a look at the 1996 presidential campaign. The core issues, affirmative action, issues of criminal justice, Proposition 187 in California restricting immigrants' rights, welfare reform, all of these issues directly or indirectly reverberate with race and ethnicity. And so a white working class family, which can't buy a home in the suburbs, which their parents could have afforded a generation ago, are told that the fault is not due to declining wages, but to affirmative action. If Johnny can't get into the state university in 1995 because of budget cutbacks, the interpretation is not due to a decline in public investment in education, but to affirmative action and minority quotas. That's how race is manipulated to obscure the real economic reality of losing ground for millions of white Americans.
Can I suggest another way I think whites really lose out in racism?
How's that?
Well, the alienation that you've been talking about among young African Americans, I mean, I think for some people that is so profound, and some of that is really directed at American politics in general, often directed around white people in general. And, you know, one can really understand how that alienation grew and how deep it is. And it can be a very destructive feeling, both for the person who has it and for the people it's directed at.
That's right. Now, the problem with racism is that it oppresses both the oppressor and the oppressed. It afflicts us and distorts our visions of each other. It cripples our language, and it cripples our hearts. That doesn't mean that we have forget about or obscure in any way the real impact of racial inequality within black reality and within the black experience in this country. Far from it. When I argue we must go beyond black and white, African Americans can never forget our historical experiences of discrimination. But we must have a democratic vision the way Martin did at the end of his life, Du Bois, Fannie Lou Hamer, at the end of his life, Malcolm X as well, to reach out to broader currents and colors and languages within the society to engage in a democratic project that empowers the poor, that addresses human needs, that creates the context for universal health care, and creates an economic environment of productivity in our central cities. That's a dream deferred, to paraphrase Langston Hughes, the African-American poet, but it's a dream that must be realized in our lifetimes, because we are moving toward a racially and class polarized society of such a profound degree that I fear for the future of this country.
Manning Marable, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I had a great time.
Manning Marable's new collection of essays is called Beyond Black and White. He directs the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. This is Fresh Air.